burial sites and learn what you can do to help end abortion. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
And welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Guest today is Russell Shaw. I've had Russell on the show a couple of times before. I consider him the preeminent Catholic journalist, commentator, and now historian in our country of American Catholicism, which he wouldn't want me to use that phrase, but we'll discuss that later. His many, many books include To Shoot, To Hunt, To Entertain, Clericalism and the Catholic Laity, Nothing to Hide, Secrecy, Communication, and Communion in the Catholic Church. And the last time he was on his show, we discussed his book, From Ignatius, American Church, The Remarkable Rise, Meteoric Fall, and Uncertain Future of Catholicism in America. That came out in 2013. And today we're going to discuss his recent book, which is really a kind of second volume extension of the same issues he raised in the 2013 book, entitled Great American Catholics, Religious Identity and Cultural Assimilation from John Carroll to Flannery O'Connor. That's also Ignatius Press. And Russ, you and I have been friends a long time, and so before we start to discuss your book, I'd like to read to you, if I can quickly find it, the review that I just put up on Amazon of your book. I just wrote this.
Okay.
A few minutes ago. I cannot praise this book too highly. It ought to be in the home of every Catholic family in America. Through succinct portraits of 15 Catholic Americans, Shaw has produced a very readable and thoroughly informed overview of the tensions between being an American and being a Catholic. Shaw has really outdone himself this time.
Well, that's very, very generous of you, Dale.
No, it's exactly what you've done. And you and I, you know, we've always been honest with each other and on our agreements and disagreements. And I sat down and started reading this book at 8 this morning, and I read right through it. It just pulled me all the way through all 15 chapters.
They're interesting people, 15 very interesting people who played a very significant role in the history of American Catholicism.
And it made me proud to be a Catholic in America.
Great.
You know,
I'm glad it did.
And it also, I mean, it's so relevant to so many things that, you know, I'm involved in, politics and so forth, but also in the battle against the secularism of the culture and the growing secularism of Catholics in the culture and the church itself. But we get ahead of ourselves. Where should we begin? I guess that I'll just quote you on what the central question you raise in the book is, and it is this. You say, can we still be fully Catholic while also being fully American in American secular terms? What would you say your answer was to that in this book?
I'd say the answer is no. And the crucial part of what you read is in American secular terms. That's the rub. There's the problem. The culture has changed. American culture has changed since the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s and on through the 1970s and on up to, you know, even as we speak, it continues to change. And the change is not going to help in a healthy direction compatible with traditional religion or compatible certainly with Roman Catholicism and the Catholic belief system. So whereas assimilation into that secular culture at one time in American history and in American history, American Catholic history, it was a workable proposition, and it guided the church's leadership in the United States all through the 19th century and on into well into the 20th century. But that's, I repeat, that has changed. What was a workable proposition back then is no longer a workable proposition. We still inevitably have to become part of American society and American culture, and we are a part of it. But we can't be uncritical participants in it, or, you know, our commitment to the church and our Catholic identity is finished.
Well, you know, Russell, one thing that jumped out at me, and I'm skipping down toward the end of your book to the Jesuit father, John Courtney Murray, is that by the early 60s, Murray had decided that the very concept of natural law, which he had earlier seen to be the kind of connecting piece between the Catholic faith and the American experiment, was no longer possible. And you quote him, you say, where Americans had at one time consented to policies and laws because they embodied a moral tradition that they held in common, today no such moral tradition lives among the American people. The tradition of reason, which is known as the tradition of natural law, is dead. Now, he said that even before the 60s went crazy.
That's right. That's right. So Murray understood the workings of the psyche and of the American cultural elite, and the natural law tradition had died among those people long before the 60s, and that's what Murray was talking about.
Let's focus on any viable
understanding of natural law, much less commitment to it among the intellectual leaders of America.
One thing you get into about Murray, which I think our listeners would be interested in, is that, you know, John Courtney Murray, in his, you know, his very, very famous book, We Hold These Truths, is often connected with our Catholic President John F. Kennedy, but you point out that Father Murray was no great fan of JFK.
I think not. Back in 1960, as you well recall, I'm sure, in September of 60, Kennedy went down to Houston, Texas, to assure an audience of Protestant ministers that if he were elected president, he, Kennedy, would not be influenced by his religious faith. And Kennedy's whole approach to the relationship between religious faith and public life, politics, was, it was to keep them as far apart as possible. He made that dichotomy, which the Second Vatican Council roundly deplored and condemned as one of the most serious mistakes of the present day, the dichotomy between faith and public life. And that speech by Kennedy was a turning point, and he marked out a path which many of our Catholic politicians have been following and capitalizing on ever since. In any case, Murray had no time for that kind of thinking, the kind of thinking that John Kennedy articulated as his rationale for a Catholic and public life, namely to keep his faith out of his conduct as an office holder. That was an attempt to dichotomize one's own conscience in a way which Murray thought was absolutely unacceptable and rather absurd, too.
By the way, you know, speaking of your Kennedy chapter, you, I'll quote you, not surprisingly, his religious knowledge was scanty and superficial. My question to you is, this was a speech in 1960. It's 12 years before Roe versus Wade. Yet, as you point out, Catholic politicians during and after Roe versus Wade took their cue, so to speak, from this distinction between private and public. Do you think that Kennedy should be held responsible for what was done on the abortion issue with this distinction?
I sometimes feel a measure of gratitude that John Kennedy was not around at the time of Roe versus Wade, because I suspect, I'm trying to be fair to Kennedy, but I suspect that Kennedy might well have found grounds for rationalizing what the Supreme Court did in Roe versus Wade.
You think he would have gone the same direction?
I think so. Well,
his brother Ted changed his mind on abortion that year after talking to some Jesuit priests who went out to visit him at the Kenny Buck. Is there a place up there in Massachusetts?
Cape Cod, out there on Hyannisport.
Yeah, Hyannisport, right? I get them mixed up with the Bush's place. But so Kennedy could be contrasted in your book, could he not, with Al Smith?
There's an enormous contrast. Yes, you put your finger on something very significant there. You know, as I was working on the book and reading more than I'd ever read before about Al Smith, frankly, I came more and more and more to like and deeply respect Al Smith.
Yeah, that comes through in your book.
Both as a politician and as a Catholic. And Smith was a very, very successful and very canny politician. He served four terms as the governor of New York.
And this is in the 1920s.
This was in the 1920s. He's a four-term governor of New York, leading figure in the Democratic Party for many years. The happy warrior, as Franklin Roosevelt called him in 1924. But in 1928, Smith finally obtained the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Smith ran for president, and his candidacy touched off a really vicious and virulent wave of that old-time anti-Catholicism. So unlike Kennedy, who years later was again to face his 1960s-style anti-Catholicism when he ran for president, unlike Kennedy, Smith didn't back down or back off from his religious commitments and his faith. Smith eloquently and courageously defended not only himself, but his church. And I take my hat off to him. I wouldn't say that his Catholicism and his defense of the church cost him the 1928 election, but it sure cost him an awful lot of votes. And I'm sure it hurt him deeply, the anti-Catholicism that he had to tried to combat in that year. But in a way, he didn't care, because he was too good a man and too firm a Catholic to compromise his faith for a few crummy votes in an American election.
Do you think that Al Smith would have made a good president?
Again, I see the hand of Providence in Smith's defeat in 1928. The next year, the stock market crashed. The Great Depression was upon us. If a Catholic had been in the White House at the time those things happened, I have no doubt but that some crack-brained bigot would have blamed the Pope. So I'm just as glad, you know, from that particular point of view, that that Al Smith did not win the 1928 presidential election. They couldn't hang that one on the Pope, anyway.
Let's go back to the beginning of your book. You begin, obviously, very naturally with Archbishop John Carroll, who was this country's first bishop, and then first archbishop. But what I didn't know that you told me in your chapter is that he was part of a delegation sent to Canada to try and recruit Canada to help in the revolution.
Yeah, it's not a widely known aspect of John Carroll's career, but there it is. He was enlisted, I think, by another member of the Carroll family. This was a very prominent Catholic family, the Carrolls of Maryland. Another member of the Carroll family served as part of the delegation, and so did Benjamin Franklin. And they enlisted young Father Carroll to accompany them up there to French-speaking Canada because they thought the presence with the delegation of a Catholic priest would sweeten their message to the French Canadians: join us in rebellion against the British throne. But it didn't work. As a matter of fact, the Declaration of Independence had kind of put the kibosh on any possibility of the French Canadians joining the colonists down south in rebellion against King George III, because King George had granted some concessions to the Catholics of Canada. And that was one of the complaints that the American revolutionaries raised against King George in explaining their decision to go into a state of rebellion and throw off the tyrant.
You know, another thing, I'm talking with Russ Shaw about his brand new book from Ignatius entitled Great American Catholics, Religious Identity and Cultural Assimilation from John Carroll to Flannery O'Connor. I didn't realize that we had our first bishop in the United States was in favor of liturgy in the vernacular.
It's surprising how up to date, how forward looking in some ways Carroll was. Yes, he thought a vernacular liturgy would be a good thing, and he thought that it would be a good thing if the local church were much more involved in the selection of bishops than it turned out to be. You know, actually, Carroll was nominated, so to speak, by the handful of Catholic priests in the United States at that time. He was nominated, and his nomination, if you call it that, was seconded and approved and authorized, and then he was officially appointed bishop by the Pope of that day. But Carroll, you know, looked upon that as a good way of selecting a bishop, and a very good way, he thought, in the context of the American democratic thing. Carroll was concerned throughout his career as bishop and archbishop to allay any American suspicions of the democratic loyalties of Catholics and Catholicism. So the more that could be done, in his view, to paint the church as a friendly entity, friendly towards American-style democracy, the better, as far as John Carroll was concerned, and the better precisely from the point of view of winning acceptance for American Catholics and achieving their assimilation into American society.
Well, if Archbishop John Carroll represents that moment in the relationship between the Catholic Church and America, your next chapter, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, I think represents the kind of gift of compassion, of service, of institution building that Catholics brought to America. Because, as most people know, she is considered the beginning of the, or have founded the first parochial school and parochial school system, and she also opened the first Catholic orphanage in the United States. A terribly important person whose family was extremely upset when she converted to Catholicism.
Yes, it was her husband's family. Elizabeth Seton, like the man she married, was an Episcopalian. She was a devout Episcopalian. She's a deeply religious person from her very early years. Her husband died young, leaving her as a young widow with several young children. And then, you know, this dreadful thing happened. She and her children were rejected by her husband's family. Her husband's at that time rather well-to-do family, leaving her to her own resources, her own rather slim resources, to try to provide for herself and her young family. In that aspect, I think Elizabeth Seton's life and career eminently and painfully illustrates the intensity and depth of anti-Catholicism in those years in the early 19th century. I mean, imagine a young widow being rejected by her late husband's family because she'd become a Roman Catholic. It's hard to imagine, but it happened. Mrs. Seton, Mother Seton, was a resourceful and a courageous woman, and eventually after contacts with Archbishop Carroll and other leaders in the Catholic hierarchy in this country, she went into education. She opened a little school out in rural Emmitsburg, Maryland, outside Baltimore. And that little bitty school of Elizabeth Seton, and conducted by herself and her sisters in religion, that little bitty school is regarded as pretty much the first Catholic school, or very nearly the first in the whole United States. So she is hailed today as a founder of the Catholic school system, which over down the better part of two centuries now.
Yet she died very, very young.
She died quite young, and a lot of people died quite young in those years. It was not uncommon. She died young, but she achieved a lot. She wrote some beautiful stuff. If you read her prayers, her religious meditations, it's deeply moving stuff. And the irony is that the school system she founded was an enormous success for well into the 20th century. But since the 1960s, like so many other things in American Catholicism, it's experienced at least a numerical and statistical decline. There are now fewer than half as many children enrolled in Catholic elementary and secondary schools in the United States as there were back in mid-1960s. And that in itself is a sad development.
Now, would that be a symptom of the issue you're addressing in this book about the?
In part, it has something to do with a change in the attitudes of many Catholic parents who don't see any good reason any longer to make significant sacrifices in order to obtain a Catholic education for their kids. It's an indication of the catechetical crisis which occurred in Catholic education the two decades after the Second Vatican Council. I think we've got over the worst part of that crisis, and the schools are now pretty strong in the area of religious education. But there was a time not too long ago when they were not strong at all. And it's a reflection, too, of the anti-Catholic sentiments embedded in law and public policy in the United States. The refusal to give any significant financial assistance to Catholic parents who continue to choose and utilize Catholic schools in pursuing their right to have their education, their children educated that way.
We have a few minutes left, but I wanted to tell you that I had one puzzlement reading the book about what symptoms of American secularism you were referring to until I came across this sentence. You were talking about Pope Leo's document that was written in the form of a letter to Gibbons, to Cardinal Gibbons, entitled
right.
Witness to Goodwill. And you glossed that by saying you were talking about American habits. You wrote, these include support for a version of religious life largely cut off from supernatural roots and the idea that everyone is entitled to his own opinion in matters religious thanks to direct inspiration by the Holy Spirit as if by, quote, a kind of hidden instinct.
Yes.
And I understood exactly what you were getting at.
It's all in there in the Pope's letter, Testem Benevolentiae. That's the Latin name for the document. You know, Americanist Catholic historians, when they get to the story of Pope Leo and Americanism, they tend to gloss over what Leo XIII had to say. They say there was no such thing as an Americanist heresy in American Catholicism. That's just a phantom heresy. And as for the Pope's document, it was most unfortunate, but they don't tell you what the Pope said. Sit down and read...
Well, you just did.
If you sit down and read what the Pope said, you say, my goodness, he put his finger on some... Maybe the problems of his day, but certainly... the problems in Catholicism of our day. If those problems didn't exist back then, they've come into full flower ever since. And it's a document of enormous prescience and insight, I would say.
Yeah, it is, especially when you aim it at the whole issue of the cafeteria Catholic, which kind of sums up what I just quoted from your book. It's the existence of the cafeteria Catholic.
Pope Leo didn't use that expression, but that's what he was talking about.
I am talking to Russell Shaw, who has just published a great book from Ignatius Press entitled Great American Catholics, Religious Identity and Cultural Assimilation from John Carroll to Flannery O'Connor. And we'll be talking about Flannery O'Connor, Dorothy Day, Archbishop Sheen, and others right after this brief pause.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
I hope God's grace touches many people this weekend, drawing us to unite and to receive the Lord Jesus in the Holy Eucharist and in the wise words of Scripture. These are the ways God usually strengthens and builds us up. One day, Jesus was asked, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" Good question. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your being, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Do this and you will live. It boils down to this, doesn't it? Love God and love your neighbor. Which naturally leads to the question, who is my neighbor? And to answer this, Jesus told a parable. You know it well, but you live it out in your daily life. A man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho through bandit country. And fell victim to robbers who beat him up and left him half dead. The priest went down that road, but when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise, a Levite, when he saw him, passed by on the other side. I'm not going to judge them. But a Samaritan traveller who came upon him was moved with compassion. He approached the victim, bandaged his wounds, took him to an inn and cared for him. Then he took 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. Take care of him, he said. If you spend more than that, I'll repay you on my way home. Which of these 3 was neighbor to the victim of the robber? He answered, the one who treated him with mercy. Jesus said, go and do likewise. Remember this is the year of mercy. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read today at Mass. Remember, inspired by the word of God, you can be more fully alive.
Back with Russell Shaw. We're talking about his latest book, Great American Catholics, Religious Identity and Cultural Assimilation from John Carroll to Flannery O'Connor. And Russ, let's go to the last figure that you discuss in your book, and that's the figure of the great Catholic writer Flannery O'Connor. And you subtitle this chapter Against Assimilation, and as I read it, I thought you were almost setting up Flannery as a kind of paradigm of not assimilating as a Catholic, of being a Catholic first and foremost. Is that the right sense of what you were trying to say?
Yes, to a considerable extent, Dale, that's the idea, although I was also trying to suggest something else, that Flannery O'Connor, of course, was a committed Catholic, a a serious Catholic, a devout Catholic, and she was also happened to be a writer of genius. I constantly return to her short stories and her novels as sources of insight and inspiration. And as a very gifted writer, she faced a challenge. I think many gifted people would understand this challenge quite well. What is the price of success? Going to be for me in a secularized American culture? Because O'Connor didn't want pious, fluffy little pieces.
No, she didn't.
Her style was to write stories about rather bizarre.
She shocked people.
Doing bizarre, violent things. And she didn't write about Catholics either. She wrote by preference about the Southern Baptists. And
they were the people she knew growing up in Milledgeville and in Savannah, Georgia.
Yeah, she was a Southerner herself and proud of it. And she wrote about the religious lives of the people she knew, namely these Southern Protestants of a very conservative, fundamentalist sort. Her constant theme, she once said, her theme in all of her fiction was depict the activity of God's grace in the lives of people who did not want to receive God's grace. So there was a constant struggle going on between God and the reluctant prophets about whom she so often wrote. And people challenged her sometimes too.
They still do. I often find that when I recommend reading Flannery O'Connor to Catholics, they sometimes come back to me and say, "Why would you ask me to read something that's so violent and sometimes sexual and deviant?" I mean, she still gets that kind of reaction.
And why don't you write about Catholics? I mean, too. Why don't you write nice little stories about some of your fellow Catholics? Well, O'Connor's response to that sort of criticism was forthright and pretty gutsy. She said she put it this way: you know, if you're trying to convey a message to an audience of people who are hard of hearing, what you have to do is shout at
them.
And I'm trying to convey a message, a spiritual message, a message about the activity of God's grace to an audience of secularized intellectuals, the literary set in New York and places like that. Those are the people to whom I'm trying to preach my gospel, and I have to write this way in order to communicate anything to those people whose ears are closed to religion and spirituality. So it's pretty convincing rationale for me. Whether she succeeded, I don't know, but she's certainly succeeded in impressing and deeply moving some of the rest of us.
Well, she has become one of the recognized great writers of American history, and certainly of the 20th century. And there's that famous story about, you know, she was a very young writer. She had just published Wise Blood, and she was at a dinner party in New York with prominent writers, including the Catholic Mary McCarthy. And the issue of the Eucharist came up, and McCarthy, who is a Catholic, said, "Well, that's just a symbol." To which Flannery replied, "If it's just a symbol, to hell with it."
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's a famous.
That's pretty good. That's a pretty good story for your book,
which sums up Flannery O'Connor and her attitude towards her faith. She also, somebody once challenged her, said something like, "How can you, as a Catholic, afford to be an artist?" And her answer was, "As a Catholic, I cannot afford to be less than an artist."
Let's move backward to Dorothy Day, who in some way reminds me of Flannery in the way we've described her. Of course, I think politically she was in a very different place. But one thing that struck me is that as you write that in 1927 Dorothy Day was received into the Catholic Church, and I'm thinking here she was in New York City at the height of flapper culture. And yet she was, she had no part of that whatsoever, and she went on to become and still is a leading figure in among Catholics who care deeply about the poor and about social justice.
Yes, and that wasn't a late commitment of Dorothy Day's either. She was committed to the poor, the oppressed, from her very early years. I recently read a collection of some of her early, in fact, teenage journalism pieces she published in a socialist newspaper in New York. Back around 1916, 1917, something like that, when she herself was just in her late teens, Dorothy Day. And even back then, even as a teenager, she was expressing this deeply felt compassion for and commitment to help and serve the poor, and to do so in terms of social action. She was not just a theorist, not just a writer about these things. She was an activist. She went on the front lines. She spent time in jail for her faith, for public participating in demonstrations and things like that. And she believed in it intensely. Believed in it all her life. To me, after her religious conversion, Dorothy Day becomes a model, a paradigm, in the word you used before, of countercultural Catholicism.
Yeah, and you mentioned that in terms of Flannery O'Connor, too, and the quote from Walker Percy that you have in your final chapter. You don't treat Percy in a chapter, but you quote him, and the word counterculture comes up in all of these contexts.
Yeah, I think that's a key word in trying to understand what the role of the Church and what the role of faithful American Catholics has to be today. This notion of uncritical assimilation into the secular culture, we can't buy into that any longer. That can't be our role. We have to be participants in, but also critics of, this secular culture. Otherwise, we're going to be in the position, and many people have said this, we're going to be in the position of being evangelized by the culture rather than being evangelists of the culture.
Well, isn't that the case of any culture? I was thinking of the focus here on Americanism and the bad habits, the secularism of Americans. I mean, are we any worse in that respect than some of the great traditional Catholic countries of Europe, Italy, France, Ireland? I mean, did we lead the way toward cafeteria Catholicism?
What I find particularly destructive about so much of American secular culture today, the secularist culture, is not only the fact that adherents of the value system of that culture do bad things, but the culture supplies them with a rationale and justification for doing bad things. And I'm thinking of things like, the legalization of abortion and same-sex marriage, and there's quite a catalog of specific instances of what I'm talking about, instances of things which are now, as I repeat, rationalized and justified by
legalized
the culture, and legalized by the culture and imposed on us by very often by people in high positions in our government.
Well, one contrast would be what's going on in Poland right now, where the new president of Poland wants to enact a complete abortion ban. I don't think that would be possible in the United States anytime in the near future.
Unfortunately not. No, we're all on the other, in the other direction. It's just all too recent that our Supreme Court once again let us know that any hope of placing significant restrictions even on the performance of abortion, any hope of doing that can be abandoned because the Supreme Court is not going to let it happen.
You call Archbishop Fulton Sheen the evangelist of the American way. I already mentioned that by 1960, John Courtney Murray had seen the destruction of the way of reason, the way of natural law, that it was dead. Did Archbishop Fulton Sheen see that? Did he address that?
Well, probably not as clearly as Murray did, because, you know, the heyday of Fulton Sheen was, the heyday of religion in America in the 20th century, the 1950s, I mean. It's not that Sheen, you know, just came on the scene back in the 1950s. Father Sheen and later Monsignor Sheen and then Bishop Sheen had been a significant figure in American Catholicism since the 1930s, and he was a radio personality and had made quite a reputation for himself on the radio. But by the 1950s, in that post-war era, those were boom times, you know, for religion generally.
He was the highest-rated television show in America. He was beating out Milton Berle.
It was extraordinary. He got in on the ground floor of that new medium, and he knew how to work with television. He knew how to do it. He just had he was a great speaker, a great preacher, but he was
charisma personified,
an uncanny knack for communicating via that new medium of television. So yes, he was an enormous success. It's an extraordinary thing in retrospect, and I can't see any way short of something of a quasi miraculous.
Well, there was no assimilation in Fulton Sheen.
Assimilation? No.
Yeah.
No. Assimilation. Sheen was a thoroughgoing Roman Catholic. He was also a very well-educated and erudite man. If he'd chosen another career path, he could probably have accomplished a great deal as a professional in philosophy, in Thomistic philosophy. But he chose instead to be a popular communicator. And popular he was, and communicator, he was a communicating genius. And he came along at the right time in the heyday of religion generally in America, and got in on the ground floor of television, and my, did he make an impact in his time.
I'm talking with Russell Shaw about his newest book, Great American Catholics, from Ignatius Press, which I think should be in the home of every American family, and I mean that. I get the feeling in your chapter on Cardinal Francis Spellman that he was someone you think went a bit far in pushing the American way.
Well, there was that famous incident toward the end of his career. Cardinal Spellman, by virtue of his office as Archbishop of New York, was also the military vicar, that is, the bishop, as it were, of members of the American Armed Forces. And during the Second World War, actually, he initiated a series of Christmas season trips to visit the troops overseas, a practice which he kept up for many, many years. Along comes the Vietnam War, and it, of course, became increasingly unpopular back home. In any case, in connection with one of his Christmas season trips to visit the boys in Vietnam, Spellman was asked what he thought of American war policy in that unhappy country. And Spellman's answer was, "My country, right or wrong," words attributed to the American naval hero Stephen Decatur. And Spellman, may I use the word, Spellman was very nearly crucified by his critics back in the United States, people who were also at that time pretty well turned off on the Vietnam War.
Did he admit
intolerable?
Did he admit to misspeaking on that?
Was he misspeaking? I suspect that if he'd anticipated the violent negative reaction that he received, he would have found some other way of expressing himself and saying, "My country, right or wrong." But, you know, my heart goes out to Cardinal Spellman. My heart goes out to Stephen Decatur, as a matter of fact. There's nothing wrong with saying, "My country, right or wrong," if it's simply an affirmation of the fact that it is your country. Whether it's right or wrong, it remains your country, and you owe it loyalty and love as a patriotic citizen. But you also owe it honest criticism when it puts its foot in it. And,
yes.
And that's part of, you know, right or wrong, too.
Well, he was a Cold Warrior. And the Cold Warriors didn't back off.
They didn't back off. He was, you know, a strong, unyielding anti-communist. So was Fulton Sheen, for that matter. Many, many people in the church, high and low, during those decades, were deeply involved in, deeply immersed in the anti-communist sentiment of the time, and with good reason. The communist menace was very real, and the Cold War was not a fiction. But the rhetoric sometimes went a bit overboard.
Well, let's go backward in times in terms of the Archbishops of New York, and let's talk about Dagger John Hughes. I can never hear enough stories about him, and you tell it well. Is he a man? Did he ever really get in any fistfights with anybody? That's what I want to know.
Nothing I've read suggests that he did, but if somebody had taken a swing at him, I think he kind of hoped he did.
I want him to have done that. He certainly took on anybody and everybody who tried to be anti-Catholic or tried to criticize the building of St. Patrick's Cathedral, and he took on Orestes Brownson, who evidently moved across the Hudson River, right?
That's right. Brownson was a pretty feisty guy, too, a public intellectual, a convert, a writer, an editor. He'd shifted his base of operations to New York from Boston, but he ran into trouble with Archbishop Hughes. The two of them were, shall I say, put it mildly, strong personalities. Conflict was inevitable. And Brownson eventually realized that prudence was the better course of action in the circumstances, and he moved again across the river to New Jersey rather than tangle forever with the Archbishop of New York.
Well, you tell a story about Dagger John Hughes that I didn't know. I didn't realize that he was he went to Europe on behalf of the U.S. government. William Seward about the Civil War. Tell that story.
Isn't that fascinating? Seward, of course, had been governor of New York, and as in that role, he'd gotten to know and become friendly with Archbishop Hughes, the Archbishop of New York. Seward, of course, served as Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State during the Civil War, and during the really difficult days of the war, were difficult for the North, difficult for the Union. Seward and Lincoln were deathly afraid that France and Spain might extend diplomatic recognition to the Confederacy, which would have been very, very bad for the Union. So Seward, harking back to his long-standing friendship with Archbishop Hughes, asked Hughes to undertake a sort of private, personal, secret mission, and go to Europe and do his very best to persuade Catholic France and Catholic Spain not to extend diplomatic recognition to the Confederacy. And the Archbishop did it. Hughes went to Europe. And he eventually secured an audience with the French emperor of that day, Napoleon III. And shortly after Hughes had made the case for not recognizing the Confederacy, the emperor told the French government, no, we're not going to recognize the South, forget about it. And as for Spain, Hughes talked to a couple of high-ranking cardinals, Spanish cardinals, and apparently made the case for non-recognition successfully to them, because Spain didn't recognize the Confederacy either. So, you know, Hughes was able to report back to his friend Seward that he'd accomplished the mission for which he'd been drafted, and he hoped that the president was well pleased. And I suspect Lincoln was quite well pleased.
I think it's a case that Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, had reached out to the Holy Father on behalf of the Confederate States.
Yes,
for support.
For reasons I still don't fathom, there was a certain degree of sympathy in Rome toward the Confederacy. So it was important to persuade not Rome not to go lean too heavily in that direction either.
I think they liked the quality of cotton that was coming out of the South.
Well, it had a lot to do with cotton, yeah.
And the it's sad. How many years ahead of the completion of St. Patrick's Cathedral did Archbishop Hughes die?
Oh, my goodness. He'd been dead, I believe, 15 years or more before the cathedral was completed and dedicated. But he's the man who got it started. It was his project. It was Hughes's final great gift to the Archdiocese of New York and to the Church in the United States.
And he is also responsible for battling Horace Greeley, I believe, at the beginning of the founding of the American public school system over the anti-Catholicism that was placed in it right at the beginning. Is that correct?
Well, yes, and Hughes would take on anybody he saw as an enemy of the Church and enemy of Catholicism, as he, Hughes, understood it. He was, as I think is eminently clear, he was a man of conviction and considerable courage and no small temper.
You know, we have about 4 minutes left, Russ, and the question I really wanted to ask you when I put down this book is that this resistance toward assimilation that you talk about, this counterculturalism, doesn't that really begin from the inside? I mean, isn't that really a spiritual interior effort and habituation? Doesn't it begin there?
Oh yes, I mean, you're not going to have anything like that apart from a strong and deep and intense formation in Catholic doctrine and Catholic spirituality. So it has to begin with the formation of Catholics, not to shield them against the society, not to shield them against American secular culture, but to prepare them for the encounter and to equip them to be evangelizers of that culture.
Yeah, I was reflecting on my own political involvement, of course, as I read your book, and it occurred to me that most of the people that I've been fellow travelers with politically are people who simultaneously have been taking the Church to task for its secularization and also taking to task the whole cafeteria Catholic phenomena. So it's not necessarily true to be involved politically means that you've assimilated. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's a valid point.
Although the temptation is there. I mean, we all know that, you know, politics can screw up your head and can also screw up your priorities.
Well, politics is essential. You know, we have to be involved in the political realities of our time. But, you know, politics isn't the answer to a lot of things.
Oh, well, we all know that. The problem is human nature, to which politics cannot change.
No, that's right.
And you talk about several people who would be part of a sequel. Are you planning a sequel to this book?
Well, not right now. Maybe if I work up the energy, although I'd just as soon see somebody else take up the torch.
Well, it gave me the idea for a book, which I'll tell you about privately sometime. I want to thank you, Russell Shaw, for being once again on Church and Culture, and I want to repeat what I said earlier, that this book, and I'll give a title momentarily, should be in every home of every Catholic in the United States. It's entitled Great American Catholics, Religious Identity and Cultural Assimilation, from John Carroll to Flannery O'Connor, Ignatius Press. And the reason is it gives you an overview of Catholicism in America, the tensions between being American and being a Catholic. And there's so much here that makes you proud of what Catholics have done in America and what Catholics can still do. So, Russell Shaw, thanks for being on Church and Culture.
Well, thank you, Gil. I've enjoyed it, and I'm grateful for your great kindness and what you're saying.
Well deserved. Please, if you're listening, hang around for a moment. I'll be back after this break with another wonderful guest.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
People like to bash the faithful with statistics. For instance, you've probably heard that studies show that Christians divorce at the same rate as others. Or how about the report that claims that Christians are bad tippers? Well, according to the University of Connecticut sociologist Bradley Wright, statements like these simply don't apply to people who actually practice their faith. For instance, only 25% of weekly church-going Catholics are divorced, compared to 50% of the general population. As for tipping, a Cornell University study found that church-going Christians tip an average of 17%. Obviously, Christians aren't perfect, but practicing our faith really does give us the grace we need to stand up against the pressures the world can apply. So the next time someone tries to bash your faith with research, take it with a grain of salt. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do men say that the Son of Man is?" They reply, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." Then Jesus presses them, "Who do you say that I am?" The disciples try to dodge the question, responding with what other people are saying about Jesus. In our world today, does the same, calling Jesus a good teacher or a good man in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some even dismiss him as a myth or a legend. But the Lord is asking us for our answer. Who do you say that I am? Not what academia, entertainment, culture, or politics have to say. You. It is your choice and your Holy Spirit-inspired answer. What do you say?
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
The Common Core has been a subject of national controversy ever since it was introduced in 2009. But how are these standards actually performing? And where are they going? To hear the answer, join HSLDA's own Will Estrada on this week's Homeschool Heartbeat.
My guest this week is Will Estrada. He's the Director of Federal Relations for HSLDA. Will, it's great to have you back on the program.
Mike, thank you for having me.
Well, we've seen the federal government overreach into education for a long time. One of the more recent efforts has been the Common Core curriculum. Can you describe briefly what the Common Core is?
Mike, in the early 2000s, several organizations, the National Governors Association, the Council of Chief State School Officers, and a few others began quietly to draft math and English language arts standards. Their goal was it would be something that all 50 states would adopt and that we would have a national set of education standards. But Mike, there's more than that. There are two related pillars to the Common Core, both of which are promoted by many of the same advocates for big government and centralized education planning. One of these related pillars is nationally standardized assessments. There are two assessment consortia, PARC and SBAC. And then the other pillar is centralized data collection, collecting all the information on kids in public schools. Some of them are over 100 points of data on every single child.
So why do they do this? What's the prevailing philosophy behind the Common Core?
Mike, at its heart, it's a philosophy of centralized control over education. It's about moving education decisions away from parents, teachers, and local